Merry Christmas and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and Christmas is what we're celebrating, but it's also our topic for 2 hours today. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, is our guest. Jimmy, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Cy Kellett. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Thank you very, very much. It feels funny because, of course, we pre-record
so
for this week.
Proleptic holiday greetings.
Right. But so anything has happened that we are not aware of, and they're like, how can they be doing that show and not be mentioning this or that? Well, because we're recording it early.
It's wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. But I'm happy to get to say Merry Christmas to you. Mm-hmm. And
because we won't be here actual Christmas week, so we wouldn't get to say it then.
No. I wish I could. I was going to say I'll be on the beach somewhere. Like, I'm, that's a total lie. There's no beach
I could
go to.
But it
like,
would be
freezing
like,
out.
Like raining here in San Diego. It's raining now, in fact.
Yeah. All right. So it's all Christmas questions.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And you solicited these Christmas questions. You said to the internets, ask anything you want about Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And the internets responded.
Yep.
All right. By the way, since we are unstuck in time, usually I ask you, mm-hmm. what's on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World this week?
Mm-hmm.
But now it will be the week after Christmas. Do you know the answer to that?
Oh, yeah, sure.
All right.
Oh, I've got Mysterious World mapped out through like March.
And it's probably, it's in your head. Like,
well,
I'm sure you have what do they call those things? A spreadsheet somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. I do. But so since this Friday is New Year's Eve, we're going to be doing, or is New Year's, we're going to be doing a New Year's edition of Weird Questions.
Oh, good. Okay.
And we just did a Christmas edition last Friday of Christmas Weird Questions. So they were weird, but also Christmas.
Okay.
So people can check that out. And then the first Friday in January, we are doing an episode on called It's Always Demons? Which we look at criteria for whether demons are actually involved in a situation or not, because people leap to that conclusion a little quicker than they should.
Now, I'm not sure if I'm supposed to say this, but I don't know what I'm supposed to say about this, but Dr. Ray was in town, and you recorded a show with Dr. Ray for his TV show.
Correct.
And that's kind of what you talked about, wasn't it?
Yeah, we talked about, it's Dr. Ray, so there were some hijinks involved.
of course there were a little
bit of shenanigans.
I'd be scared to be on his show, actually, now that I think about it.
Really?
You never know exactly what's going to happen. So he hijinxed you, huh?
Well, he hijinxed the audience with me as his confederate.
Oh, okay.
So, but you can watch the show and and see what happens.
Okay, good.
We then talked about demons and mental illness.
Yeah.
And how to distinguish the two and took questions from the audience.
It was so nice that when he was out here. He's a very, very nice man.
He's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and a lot of fun. That's exactly right. All right, you ready to do some Christmas questions?
I'm ready.
All right, we start from Dan. Dan says, if the Bible describes the Star of Bethlehem as a star, why does everyone insist on proving it was something else, a comet, the confluence of Jupiter and Venus, etc.?
So The New Testament does use the Greek word for star, but there's been a shift between the first century and now in terms of how we conceptualize stars. Today, we think of stars as very distant bodies that glow under their own light, which is caused by nuclear fusion. They're burning hydrogen and helium and so forth and fusing these elements together to produce heavier elements. And that's what we think of as a star, is this supermassive, very distant, glowing body of fusing gas. And that's not how the ancients thought about stars, because they didn't have those concepts. Number one, they didn't realize the universe is nearly as big as it is.
Yeah.
So they didn't realize the stars were distant. They also, consequently, since they didn't realize they were distant, they didn't realize how big they are. They thought they were much smaller. And they didn't know at all about nuclear fusion. And so they didn't have a way to distinguish stars that burn by their own light from other heavenly bodies that reflect light. And so to the ancients, a star was simply anything in the sky at night that was light.
Yeah,
so any light in the sky is a star.
So the meaning of the word is what the evangelist would have meant by it.
Correct.
Right. So he would have meant just any old light that's up there.
Correct.
That's a star.
And then the ancients had various categories for different types of stars that they could recognize based on their appearance or behavior. Mm-hmm. In fact, the moon was a star.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, technically, it was a specific kind of star called a planetes asteres. Planetes is Greek for wandering, mm-hmm. and then asteres is star. So you had two basic kinds of stars. The first kind of star were the fixed stars that stay in the same position in the sky relative to other stars, like what you see in a constellation like the Big Dipper.
Right.
Now, technically, those stars move around, but it's so slow it doesn't happen on human time scale. So mm-hmm. they look fixed in position. They may rotate around the heavenly pole, but with respect to each other, they stay in one position, which is why the Big Dipper doesn't change shape. It just moves in the sky.
Right.
But then there were everything else, and everything else wandered against the background. And so these wandering stars, that's what planetes means, is wanderer. So anything that wandered against the background of the fixed stars was a planet. And that included the moon, because it's a light source in the sky that wanders against the background of,
right.
of fixed stars. The sun.
Oh, yeah.
The sun also moves around the background of fixed stars. It passes through the signs of the zodiac every year.
Mm-hmm.
What we think of as planets, like Mercury and Jupiter and Saturn and so forth, and then also comets. Comets were called long-haired stars or cometes asteres because of the tails they have. So all of these were considered stars, and that means when you're trying to interpret Matthew and say, well, what kind of star would have brought the Magi to Jerusalem? Well, it's probably not a fixed star, because fixed stars rise every year.
Yes.
Every single year they come up and they do their thing, and it's because they're fixed. They behave in regular, repeatable ways that are always the same. So when a star rises, there's a special kind of rising known as a heliacal rising, where a star for the first time in the year like peaks its little head up over the eastern horizon briefly in conjunction with the sun. Well, that happens every year, and it doesn't mean a new king of the Jews is born every year.
Right.
So it's probably not any of the fixed stars. And that means you would want to look to other things like what we would call planets or what we would call comets to explain what the Star of Bethlehem would have been. And as we may discuss later today, the best evidence we've got based on my research is that it was probably Jupiter, the king star, mm-hmm. doing something that was significant in the Magi's system of astrology to communicate a king was being born in Judea.
So they were just reading the signs according to their astrology.
Yes.
And they said, there's a new king in Judea. I gotcha. Let's see. That was Dan. Dan, thank you very, very much for getting us started. Well, we're already upon the first break. It's all Christmas questions today for Jimmy Akin, our senior apologist. Right back with more Christmas after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
And all the people who are working so hard to get us on radio, you know, that's wonderful. And even if you reach 100 miles or 50 miles, you help spread the word. And we do all the programming for you. Programming is the expensive stuff, you know, so you don't have to worry about programming. And so we want to thank you for everything you've done to make this radio possible.
EWTN, Live truth. Live Catholic.
Merry Christmas. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Kind of a Christmas internet open forum today. Christmas questions from all over the internet for Jimmy Akin, our senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. And the next one comes from Francis. Francis asks this. Did the wise men arrive 1.5 to 2 years after Christ's birth? If that's the case, where is it they were living? What town? What conditions, etc.?
So they did arrive between 1 and 2 years after Christ's birth, and I know we have some more questions coming up on that, so we can discuss that further, but
okay.
Closer to a year is what the evidence seems to support. But between 1 and 2 years, and in terms of where is it they were living, I'm not sure if we're referring here to the Holy Family or the Magi.
If it's
the Holy Family, well, they could have remained in Bethlehem, or they could have gone back to Nazareth for a while and come back to Bethlehem. But those would seem to be where the Holy Family was living. If we mean the Magi, it's not clear. We know they came from the east, but there were multiple different cultures to the east of Judea. There have been proposals that the Magi were Babylonian, or that they were Jews living in Babylon, although that seems to not be the case, or that they were Persian, or that they were Nabataean. And there have been different arguments about that. We know they were from some Eastern group of people, but we don't know for sure which one. If you'd like more information, you can check out episode 75 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, which is devoted to the mysteries of the Magi and what we can figure out about them.
All right. Francis, thank you very, very much. More to come, I gather, on the Magi as we go through the program today. All Christmas questions during this 8 days of Christmas here special show with Jimmy Akin. Another Dan asks this. When Mary went to see Elizabeth, was it in a caravan, or is she supposed to have traveled alone through that dangerous country?
So the age of Mary at this time is unclear. We're not definitely told in Scripture. There is a document from the 2nd century known as the Infancy Gospel of James. It's also called the Proto-Evangelium of James, but Proto-Evangelium is such an intimidating word that scholars these days are more commonly calling it the Infancy Gospel of James. And it says that when Jesus was born, Mary was 16. So she would have been 15, perhaps, when the Annunciation happened and mm-hmm. when she went down to visit Elizabeth. And it is extremely unlikely that a teenage girl would have been allowed to travel the approximately 100 miles between Nazareth and the Judean hill country alone.
Right.
It's very, very unlikely that would have been allowed to happen. Now, it could have been she went as part of a caravan because there were these annual pilgrimages, and apparently people from Nazareth would travel down as a group for protection against bandits mm-hmm. and other criminals. And she could have come down as part of like a large village caravan, maybe for one of the feasts, and then she stayed over until the next feast. We're told she was there for about 3 months and then went back after the next feast. I'd have to do some thinking about that and see how that maps onto the Jewish liturgical calendar. Mm-hmm. But if it wasn't part of a village caravan, it at least would have been like a group of family members or someone that the family knew and trusted that
right.
went down, because you typically did not travel long distances alone. It was simply too dangerous at the time.
All right, Dan, thank you very, very much for that question. We continue with our internet Christmas open forum. Suzanne asks this. The lifelong question in our house as the kids were growing up was how Santa could squeeze down that skinny opening in the chimney to put the gifts under the tree and fill the stockings. Our son would sometimes stare up the chimney and have a puzzled look on his face.
So, you know, there's no single answer to this, but there are a number of possibilities for how this could happen. One is, so there's an X-Files pair of episodes about a guy who has the ability to like dislocate his own body parts and stretch kind of like Mr. Fantastic in the Fantastic Four.
Why does that gross me out?
So hypothetically, Santa could, you know, like take his arm out of his socket and make himself really thin and stretch his way down. That wouldn't explain the way in which he gets the gifts down, though.
Right.
And so normally you don't have Santa Claus conceived of as a kind of human octopus.
No, that's,
you know, because
right.
octopuses can fit themselves through very small spaces. Mm-hmm. Among other things, because it doesn't explain the gifts. How do bigger gifts get through narrow openings? And so there are other ideas that have been proposed. Now, in movies like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, you see a kind of shrinking ability could apply both to you and to objects you're carrying, like a big sack of presents. Mm-hmm. So shrinking is a possibility. And shrinking could work in more than one way. One way it could work would be by decreasing the distance between the atoms and the subatomic particles connecting them in your body. Because as we know, matter is mostly empty space. And so hypothetically, you could find a way to do that, but to shrink the distance between them. But if you're doing that on a particle-by-particle basis, that seems very
laborious
and energy intensive.
Wow.
So I would tend to think for this to happen, you would expect something more like bending space-time. Because if you take a chunk of space and compress it, that's like kind of does it all for you, much in kind of one step, as opposed to trying to do
atom by atom.
Yeah. Right. And so I would suspect that this would be accomplished through some kind of spatial compression.
That you went a totally different direction than I was expecting on that question.
Really?
You went quite technical. No mention of PIM particles.
That's one version of the atom by atom, moving.
Suzanne, thanks very, very much for the question. It's Christmas open forum with Jimmy Akin. Let's go to Mark. Mark's question. Is Mary also descended from David? If so, she would be tribe of Judah. And even if not, she probably would still be Judah, as they were supposed to marry within their tribe. How then do we explain her kinship with Elizabeth, who was from the tribe of Levi?
So we are told at the beginning of Luke that Elizabeth is one of the daughters of Aaron. So Elizabeth was definitely of the tribe of Levi, and in fact from the most prestigious line of the tribe of Levi. However, it isn't the case that people were expected to marry within their own tribe. The priests were expected to marry fellow Israelites.
Mm-hmm.
So Zechariah did when he married Elizabeth. But priests did not have to marry Levite women. It was okay to marry other Israelites.
Okay.
And for ordinary people, you similarly did not have a requirement to marry within your own tribe. And so one way, if Mary is of the tribe of Judah, one way that that can happen is if, I want to make sure I'm answering the exact question we have here. Is Mary also descended from David? Well, we're not told in the clearest way possible,
mm-hmm.
Because the two genealogies that we have, one in Matthew and one in Luke, despite what you may have heard,
right.
neither of them is Mary's. They are both explicitly Joseph's.
And you do often hear people will resolve what is they perceive as a problem, which is not a problem.
Correct.
By saying one of these is Mary's and one of them is Joseph's.
And that is contradicted by the text. They
okay.
are both Joseph's genealogies, and they simply track Jesus's descent from David through more than one line.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can be descended from a single historical figure in multiple ways. And there can be reasons for tracking those different lines. But that shows us that Joseph is a member of the tribe of Judah. It does not show us that Mary is a member of the tribe of Judah. Is there anything else in Scripture that could point in that direction? Well, there is a passage in Romans. If you look in Romans 3, it says that Jesus was descended from David according to the flesh. So that could indicate, if you take flesh literally, that could indicate biological descent. And since Jesus only got his biology from Mary on the human level, that would mean that Mary would have to be a descendant of David in order for Jesus to be descended from David according to the flesh. The problem is that flesh is not always to be taken in that kind of literal way in Paul. Paul often talks about flesh and means something just like human nature.
Right.
You know, he'll talk about fallen human nature and sins that come from fallen human nature as sins of the flesh or things like that. And so he could just mean that humanly, Jesus was descended from David.
Right.
And if that's all he means, well, in what human ways could he descend from David? Well, biological is certainly one way you can be descended from someone, but you can also be legally descended from them.
Sure.
And so it would be sufficient if Joseph is an heir of David for him to pass on the royal lineage legally. Yeah. So I don't think Romans 1:3 tells us for sure that Mary was biologically descended from David. Having said that, it's quite possible that she was, in which case we would understand one of her ancestors was of the tribe of Judah and the family of David, and another of her ancestors was of the tribe of Levi and the children of Aaron, which would explain how she's related to Elizabeth.
A lot of times people will say Elizabeth is her cousin. But that's not.
That is not. Yeah, no, no, no. There's a different word in Greek for cousin than what is used here. The word that's used here is sungenes, and it just means kinswoman.
Yeah.
Anepsia would be the word for cousin, and it is not used in this passage. So all we can say from Luke is that Elizabeth is Mary's kinswoman. The idea that she should be described, and in fact, the current New American Bible uses kinswoman rather than cousin.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that Mary and Elizabeth were cousins was actually popularized by John Wycliffe back in the 1400s. He was the one that introduced that characterization into English. And it wasn't as restrictive as we would understand it today.
Right.
Today, when we talk about someone being a cousin, we almost invariably imagine first cousin.
Right,
you know,
right.
Someone who's like the daughter of your aunt or son or daughter of your aunt or uncle.
Right.
But actually, there are loads of different types of cousins that are more distantly related. And in Wycliffe's day, the term cousin wasn't narrowed to mean just first cousin. And so it could have been reasonable at that time, given that people were more aware of the more distantly related cousins, and it was functionally equivalent to kinswoman.
Thanks, Mark, again, for the question. It's Christmas Internet Open Forum for Jimmy Akin today. And Robert asks this, is it too cold in December for shepherds to be out tending sheep in Bethlehem?
Okay, so you know those trendy jackets that started being real popular a few years ago, those fleece jackets?
Yes.
You know what those fleece jackets are made of?
Fleece,
yeah. And you know what?
Sure, I thought that might be a trick question. No.
And they keep people warm, right? That's why they're so trendy.
Right, yes.
Well, you know where you find fleece?
Macy's.
You know where Macy's gets the fleece from ultimately?
I'm going to guess Bethlehem. No, all right, from sheeps.
From sheep, yeah. Yes. So sheep are covered in that stuff. They just like grows out of them. And
right, so they're wearing a fleece coat.
They're wearing a fleece coat and usually a much thicker one than humans are. So sheep are designed to be outdoors in the winter. They evolved that way. And so, no, it is not too cold for the sheep to be outside. And the question is it too cold in December in Judea for humans to be outside? Well, not if they're wearing a fleece jacket.
Which they probably had access to because they have sheep.
Because they had sheep, yeah. So they had winter wear clothing they could wear. And even today, the shepherds actually tend their sheep in Bethlehem in late December. There's a famous in biblical circles. There's a famous letter from the 1960s where one biblical scholar was visiting Bethlehem on Christmas and noted that at Shepherd's Field, the shepherds were actually out with the sheep and even the baby lambs were there.
Yeah.
So this is totally normal. She, in fact, if you look up winter sheep care online, yeah. it points out you do not need to bring them in
yeah.
during the cold. They can get snow on them and they're just fine. So no, it is not too cold for this to be happening in December. Now that doesn't mean that it did happen in December.
It just means this is not an argument. Yeah, yeah. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We've covered how to shrink your atoms and change the curvature of space-time to get down a chimney and all kinds of other stuff. And a lot more Christmas questions to come. Hang on. More Christmas Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's an Internet Open Forum of the Christmas variety today. All Christmas questions for Jimmy Akin, and the Internet has a lot of Christmas questions and a great variety of Christmas questions. So now we have a question from a priest, Father Matthew. We all know the math that Santa would need to travel so fast he would disintegrate. But that's to deliver the presents on Christmas Eve. But if Santa were to somehow survive, would that be a valid miracle? In a cause for canonization. St. Nicholas was canonized before the formal process, so if it works, it could theoretically be for his cause.
So the standards and the role of miracles in canonizations has changed over time. Back in the day, there was more stress put on did miracles occur during a saint's lifetime. These days, the focus is more on have miracles happened after the saint's death through their intercession, because if God is granting miraculous prayer requests through the intercession of a particular saint, that's evidence the saint is in heaven. And while miracles that occur during a saint's life could contribute to a case, it's really the postmortem miracles that would be more decisive. And in the case of Santa Claus, well, the problem, so we have St. Nicholas, who yes. was canonized by acclaim mm-hmm. Before the Pope became the one to do all this stuff, to do all the evaluations. But if Santa Claus is still flying around and is not being killed by the excessive speeds causing him to disintegrate, mm-hmm. he's still alive. He's not in heaven.
So that's not St. Nicholas. So,
well, it wouldn't be the same one anyway.
Yes,
and,
right.
And he thus would not be eligible for canonization because canon law requires that a certain amount of time pass after your death before a cause for canonization can be opened. And if he's not dead, then the canonization process cannot start.
All right. I feel like, though, if he could travel, wouldn't he travel at just like almost you have to be at the speed of light to get to everywhere?
Not the speed of light, no. But very close to it. You can also pick up some extra time if you fly west against the rotation of the Earth.
Oh, right. Because, you're just going to add... How many hours? 12 hours or 24 hours to that?
You're going to add. It depends. There's a little bit of math to do, but you basically can extend it if you yeah. are moving against the direction of the Earth rather than with it.
But I feel like if you can move that fast,
mm-hmm.
then you've probably solved the disintegration problem. I mean,
well, yeah.
You know, it's technically these would be.
And it wouldn't have to, just like earlier, it could be a spatial compression thing. It could be that in this case, there is a warp bubble around Santa as he travels this fast, and that yeah. would protect him from the effects of the massive acceleration and deceleration.
That's what
in
I thought.
In which case, it wouldn't be a miracle at all.
No, it would just be a warp bubble.
Yeah.
Which is not miraculous at all. The next one comes from Ryan. If Jesus was born on December 25th, how is it the Eastern Orthodox Eastern Catholics, I think is what that means, celebrate Christmas on the Feast of the Epiphany if it commemorates the arrival of the three wise men 12 days after Jesus was born. There's a lot of ifs in that question.
Yeah, so there are some Eastern Christians, principally Armenians, who celebrate Christmas on January 6th. And in the West, January 6th is often celebrated as the arrival of the wise men or the Epiphany, the manifestation of Christ to the nations. That's mm-hmm. what Epiphany means in Greek, is manifestation. And so the reason that you have these different interpretations of January 6th is that January 6th was originally proposed as Jesus's birthday. The early church fathers do not agree on when Jesus was born. There are a variety of different dates that they've been proposed. December 25th is one of them. So is January 6th. And actually, January 6th seems to be a little bit of an older tradition, although even then it's not the oldest. So you had in the early church some Christians celebrating Jesus's birthday on January 6th and some on December 25th and some on other dates and some not celebrating it at all. Well, over the course of time, December 25th and January 6th became the two more common ones. And they both ended up being celebrated in the West in one way or another. The West ultimately decided to celebrate Jesus's birthday on December 25th, but there was still this other tradition of celebrating it on January 6th. And so the question was, well, do we want to do it twice, or maybe we should just give a little bit of a different interpretation to January 6th, and we can keep celebrating it for traditional reasons, but we're going to understand it a little differently. And so that's how January 6th became associated with the arrival of the wise men, which was obviously an event connected with Jesus' birth, even though it was 2 years later instead of 2 weeks later. So that's how we got the January 6th thing. But there are some Christians in the East who celebrate January 6th, and I know the Armenians tend to do this, but not most. Most Eastern Orthodox and some Eastern Catholics celebrate Jesus' birthday on December 25th.
Oh.
On the Julian calendar.
Oh.
Which is different than the Gregorian calendar.
It was replaced,
because, yeah. So the Julian calendar was the one that was developed initially under Julian. I mean, it had roots earlier than this, but under Julius Caesar. And it was used for many centuries by the church, but it doesn't exactly align with the solar year. And so as a result, the Julian calendar was getting out of sync by the Middle Ages. It was getting noticeably out of sync with the seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why Pope Gregory in the 1500s commissioned a new calendar, which is known as the Gregorian calendar, which is used civilly all over the world today.
Yeah.
But not all churches use it as their liturgical calendar. In the East, because religion is very traditional, in the East, various Christians still use the Julian calendar for liturgical purposes. And so they will be celebrating Christ's birthday on December 25th on the Julian calendar, which corresponds to January 7th on the Gregorian calendar.
Oh, how interesting.
At the moment, although over centuries that'll change.
It'll change, right.
Some, I gather, celebrate both the Gregorian December 25th and the Julian December 25th. And so they actually do Christmas twice a year.
Good for them. That's the way to do that. My understanding, and I don't have a direct understanding of this, I just remember being told this as a child, that in Mexico, the tradition was always Christmas on the 25th, but the presents on the 6th.
Mm-hmm.
So they just, it was more of
the, oh, yeah. Cause presents are even more variable because that's a local culture tradition. They don't.
Yeah. So Epiphany was the day you got the, I guess, associated with the presents that the baby Jesus got.
And there also were traditions of giving presents earlier in December on St. Nicholas Day.
Yes. But we, you know, are there more questions about the dating of Christmas to come?
Somewhere in there. I don't know whether we'll get to all of them today, but we'll.
All right, I'm going to move on then. All right. What are the historical reasons? Oh, I'm sorry, Carolyn, I didn't say your name. Carolyn's question is, what are the historical reasons for the celebration of the Immaculate Conception in December?
Well, this one's pretty simple. It started to be celebrated in December in the eastern part of the Christian world back in the 7th century. And gradually it spread all over the Christian world, including in the West, and that's how it ended up on the liturgical calendar in the Latin Rite for December.
Well, that was very easy. Mm-hmm. Carolyn, thank you very much for that question. Perfect time to take a break. We'll do that right now. We'll take a quick break. Be right back with more Internet Christmas Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The EWTN On Demand platform features 50 new podcasts every week, as well as an ever-expanding library of audio and video content. For Catholics who want to learn more about their faith, simply using their mobile device, computer, or TV, your favorite EWTN programs are available 24/7. Visit EWTN.com and click On Demand. EWTN is the global Catholic network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's a internet open forum Christmas questions today. Merry Christmas. We're still in the octave of Christmas, as we Catholics say, the 8-day celebration of the Feast of Christmas, and in the Christmas season and in the Christmas mood as well. Happy to be here with you. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Hello again, Jimmy.
Hello, Cy Kellett.
Jimmy, of course, proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and there's going to be some weird questions this week on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Yeah.
Coming up on Friday of this week.
For New Year's,
and
although they're not specifically New Year's related
yeah,
questions.
Okay. All right, Marianne, I've been wanting to get to your question. I'm anxious to hear Jimmy's answers to these two questions that Marianne poses. What does Jimmy eat for Christmas dinner, and what is your all-time favorite Christmas movie?
So in regard to the first question, so I'm a widower, so I live alone, and I'm alone on Christmas Eve, and so I don't make a big deal out of cooking.
Okay.
Instead, I'll order out. And in recent years, I have been ordering. I mean, I definitely did this last year, and I'm planning on doing it again this year, which now will have been in the past.
Yeah.
But I ordered Himalayan food.
Really?
Yeah. So this is the kind of food. There are a number of local Himalayan restaurants. I mean, there are many, many restaurants of different nationalities in San Diego.
Yeah.
And there are a number of Himalayan ones. So this is the kind of food you would find in Nepal and India and places in that part of the world. And it can be very tasty. It can be spicy if you want it spicy. So I will order things like lamb vindaloo, which is a kind of...
Oh, that sounds so good.
Yeah, it's a kind of... tangy lamb, really thick lamb stew, made with garlic and wine and spices, and then I'll get like lamb vindaloo and put it over rice, you know, which they'll also send you, and so that'll kind of be the meat course, and then I also will get flatbread, which is called naan, and I like to get. Flatbread that like has garlic and cilantro on the outside, and then I also get these things called pakora, which are fritters, and there are different kinds of pakora. They have ones that I really like that are vegetable pakora. So what they do is they take different vegetables and they put them in a batter and then they deep fry them.
Oh.
And you can eat them with mint sauce. So they'll send you the mint sauce as well. So I'll have like lamb and lamb stew and rice and flatbread and vegetable fritters.
Holy smokes.
And you know, this is very tangy, spicy, aromatic food. It's very, it is not bland.
That sounds so good. But mm-hmm. if someone had said to me, I'll give you 20 guesses what kind of food Jimmy eats on Christmas Eve. Himalayan would not have come up. I would have gone 0 for 20.
Mm. What would have been your first guess?
Maybe Chinese or Japanese food.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's a kind of, back east, there's a kind of a Chinese food tradition among non-Christians, for especially Jewish people, mm-hmm. for Christmas. So I don't know, I guess.
Well, and anybody who is, in the old days in America, if you needed to order food on Christmas, Chinese was often your best bet.
Yeah, everybody else was celebrating Christmas.
Exactly. All the other restaurants would be closed. So there is a kind of tradition of Chinese in some places. And that leads to Christmas movies.
Because, Christmas movies, yes.
Because you see the family in A Christmas Story mm-hmm. go out for Chinese after the neighbor's Bumpus's dogs destroy their own food. And so to have a nice Christmas dinner at the end of the movie, they go out for Chinese. And A Christmas Story is a good Christmas movie. Now, I don't have a favorite, but there are certain movies I will watch at Christmas time. One of them is A Christmas Story, which is a classic. It's the one, if you don't remember, it's the one.
The BB gun.
The BB gun. Yeah.
Everybody remembers that.
Double action Red Ryder BB gun. You'll shoot your eye out. Yeah. So there's that one. That's very good. It's a Wonderful Life is another.
Yeah.
Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
Of course, a classic.
Yeah. And I will in particular watch the Mystery Science Theater 3000 version
of
Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
I have not seen it. Have you seen it, Darren?
It's a lot of fun.
No.
Yeah. There's also a Riff Trax version of it. And then I also might watch. Now, I'm not actually a fan of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol.
You're not?
Because it gets trotted out as, this is such a great Christmas story, and it has nothing to do with Christmas. I mean, it happens at Christmas time, but what I find is it's a kind of secular film or story that ends up distracting from the
Christmas.
Jesus message, but people will tend to present it as if it's a moving spiritual thing in a way that's different than like Santa Claus Conquers the Martians,
right,
which is just fluff and fun and fantasy and is not meant to be serious.
You don't cry at the end of that every time?
And Santa Claus Conquers, It's a Wonderful Life maybe, but not Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
Okay.
It has a very happy ending.
Yeah.
But in any event, I'm not a huge fan of A Christmas Carol.
How interesting.
Someday I need to read the original novel to see if it's different than the movies and how
it's
presented.
Do you know C.S. Lewis agreed with you? He didn't like A Christmas Carol. Although
I didn't know that.
I don't even know why I know this. G.K. Chesterton defended it. C.S. Lewis said, it's very similar to what you're saying. It's not. Mm-hmm. It's not really Christmas.
Yeah, but I acknowledge the story is a good story.
Yeah,
it's just not about the real meaning of Christmas.
Yeah,
and this is what I find annoying about presentations of A Christmas Carol is it gets presented as this is the real meaning of Christmas. No, it is not.
No,
this is Scrooge having redemption, and that's great that Scrooge has redemption.
Yeah.
But learning to love other people is not the real meaning of Christmas. And that's a counterfeit Christmas.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
But it still can be a good story, and you can even tell it at Christmas time. You just need to like make it about time travel instead. Because it's the classic time travel story. And so you've got the Ghost of Christmas Past, the Ghost of Christmas Present, the Ghost of Christmas Future, and that makes the Doctor Who A Christmas Carol Christmas special
I should have known
the
this.
Best telling of A Christmas Carol that I have ever seen. And it's the best of the Doctor Who Christmas specials where they use time travel to bring about the effects of the three ghosts. And it is a story of redemption, and it's very moving, and it's very funny, and You don't see a lot of shows that involve time travel and flying around in the sky in a sleigh on Christmas Day being pulled by a gigantic flying shark.
You just don't see that in a lot of them.
Not a lot of them. So I will sometimes watch that one, even if it's not Christmas. And also the Doctor Who Christmas special, The Return of Dr. Mysterio, is pretty good.
That's a Christmas special.
It's a Christmas special. Right. It's set at Christmas. It's a superhero story, but it's set at Christmas.
Marianne, you brought just as much happiness as I thought you would bring by asking that question, learning about the Himalayan food and the Doctor Who Dickens Christmas story. Couldn't have gone better, Marianne. Thanks for asking that. Next one comes from Robert. He says, in It's a Wonderful Life, the aforementioned movie, It's a mm-hmm. Wonderful Life, George Bailey is given a glimpse of how things would be if he had never been born. Clearly, he was transported to another reality in the multiverse. Unless there are only two realities in the multiverse, Clarence the Angel must have chosen to show the most unfavorable version of events in the infinite realities where George was never born, suggesting angels are capable of viewing infinite realities. If instead Clarence erroneously showed George a more positive reality, would it be immoral for him to try to escape Clarence so he could stay there rather than go back to his own universe? Holy smokes!
So I don't think that I would agree that, number one, I don't think angels can view infinite realities. I think Clarence was getting heavenly help in whatever realities he had access to. But I also don't think that he would have shown him the worst. I think that the logic of the movie is that George Bailey is shown what would have happened if he had not been born. And that's the only variable that changes, is just George Bailey is never born. And everything else plays out the way it would have with that one change. So there would be versions where timelines where it goes even worse because there's more than one change. Not only is George Bailey not born, but Hitler wins the war.
Yeah.
Or something like that. Or a plague wipes out all of mankind.
I got you.
So there can be even worse ones, but they involve more variables. And the logic of the drama is that this is the only variable that's changed. And you could then and philosophically, this would be interesting. You know, you'd analyze this in contemporary philosophy under possible worlds discourse. And since Clarence is getting help from heaven, one thing that a lot of philosophers would immediately think in terms of is middle knowledge, where God would have knowledge of what people would have done in certain circumstances. And so this would be based on a kind of middle knowledge view of God knows how this reality would have unfolded if George Bailey had never been born. What would people have done freely in that situation? And now I'm not personally a huge fan of middle knowledge, but it would lend itself to that kind of analysis. In terms of if Clarence made a mistake and took George to a happier, better reality, would it have been immoral for George to stay there? Well, I don't think that number one, Clarence could easily take George somewhere wrong because he's portrayed as a bumbling angel. And by the way, he's also a human, and do not trust It's a Wonderful Life for your angelology.
Right.
Humans and
Thomas
angels
Aquinas
are
would not.
Two different species. But so suppose he takes him to a better place. Well, if I take you to a better place, Cy Kellett, are you obliged to go back to where I took you from?
I don't believe I am. I don't believe I am. No.
Not always.
No, right.
What if it meant abandoning your family?
Well, yes. Okay, so that's right. There are cases in which I would be obliged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in reality, I do have a family, and I have obligations to them. So, yes, I have to go back to them.
Okay, so I would argue the same essential thing. Yeah. I don't think if George had no obligations, to help Zuzu and everybody else, then I don't think it would be wrong for him to stay in a better reality. But in fact, he does have obligations to people in his own original timeline. And in order to meet those obligations, he needs to go back to his original timeline. So I would say, given his obligations, he should go back morally.
Yeah. All right. But I mean, not to bicker with Robert, but it it sometimes seems like we present the possibility that we can think of as obviously it's this, but it's not obviously that there's a multiverse involved in this. It could just be Clarence giving him a vision,
or a holodeck.
A holodeck? I didn't even think. Mm-hmm. Yes, do angels have holodecks? That's the title of your next book. Just gave it to you, Jimmy. There you go.
We'll see.
That's a free one. You can have it.
Okay.
If the Magi, oh, this comes from Gordon, and I think we have time.
Yeah, we do.
If the Magi had seen the star in the east, why did they go west?
Well, they saw, so Matthew does say that they saw the star in the east, and exactly what that means has been debated. It could mean they see the star over the eastern horizon from where they are in the east. Mm-hmm. It could also mean that, and this has been proposed, that they that when it says they saw it rise in the east, it means they saw its heliacal rising, which we mentioned earlier in the hour, which is where a star rises briefly over the eastern horizon in conjunction with the sun. It happens once a year, and it may mean we saw the star's heliacal rising.
Okay.
It also could mean that they saw it when they were in the east.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I didn't think about that.
In which case, I think that they saw it rise over the eastern horizon. The reason they went west is because the star signified that there is a newborn king in Judea.
Right.
And Judea was in the west. So if you want to visit the newborn king, you got to go west, old man. And so people often have this idea they were being led by the star.
Right.
No. They were not being led by the star. That is a misreading of the text. At a certain point in their journey, they saw the star in front of them on their way to Bethlehem, but it did not lead them from the east to the west. That's why they went to the palace in Jerusalem, is because they knew, okay, newborn Judean king, that's what the star told them. So they went to the palace where you'd expect to find a king. They were not being led around by the nose by the star.
I can't believe an hour already gone, but we have another hour of Christmas questions. It's an open forum entirely devoted to Christmas questions from the internet for Jimmy Akin, our guest. We're going to continue with that when we come back right after this, right here on Catholic Answers Live.